Chapter 7. This is John Galt speaking. The doorbell was ringing like an alarm, in a long, demanding scream broken by the impatient stabs of someone's frantic finger. Leaping out of bed, Dagny noticed the cold, pale sunlight of late morning, and a clock on a distant spire marking the hour of 10. She had worked at the office till 4 a.m., and had left word not to expect her till noon. The white face, ungroomed by panic, that confronted her when she threw the door open, was James Taggart.
"He's gone!" he cried.
"Who?"
"Hank Reardon, he's gone! Quit, vanished, disappeared!"
She stood still for a moment, holding the belt of the dressing gown she had been tying. Then, as the full knowledge reached her, her hands jerked the belt tight, as if snapping her body in two at the waistline, while she burst out laughing. It was a sound of triumph. He stared at her in bewilderment.
"What's the matter with you?" he gasped. "Haven't you understood?"
"Come in, Jim," she said, turning contemptuously, walking into the living room. "Oh, yes, I've understood."
"He's quit, gone. Gone like all the others, left his mills, his bank accounts, his property, everything, just vanished. Took some clothing and whatever he had in the safe in his apartment. They found a safe left open in his bedroom, open and empty. That's all. No word, no note, no explanation. They called me from Washington, but it's all over town. The news, I mean. The story. They can't keep it quiet. They've tried to, but nobody knows how it got out, but it went through the mills like one of those furnace breakouts. The word that he'd gone, and then, before anyone could stop it, a whole bunch of them vanished. The superintendent, the chief metallurgist, the chief engineer, Reardon's secretary, even the hospital doctor, and God knows how many others. Deserting, the bastards! Deserting us in spite of all the penalties we've set up! He's quit! And the rest are quitting, and those mills are just left there standing still. Do you understand what that means?"
"Do you?" she asked. He had thrown his story at her, sentence by sentence, as if trying to knock the smile off her face, an odd, unmoving smile of bitterness and triumph. He had failed.
"It's a national catastrophe! What's the matter with you? Don't you see that it's a fatal blow? It will break the last of the country's morale and economy. We can't let him vanish. You've got to bring him back."
Her smile disappeared.
"You can," he cried. "You're the only one who can. He's your lover, isn't he? Oh, don't look like that. It's no time for squeamishness. It's no time for anything except that we've got to have him. You must know where he is. You can find him. You must reach him and bring him back."
The way she now looked at him was worse than her smile. She looked as if she were seeing him naked, and would not endure the sight much longer. "I can't bring him back," she said, not raising her voice. "And I wouldn't if I could. Now get out of here."
"But the national catastrophe—"
"Get out." She did not notice his exit. She stood alone in the middle of her living room, her head dropping, her shoulders sagging, while she was smiling. A smile of pain, of tenderness, of greeting to Hank Reardon. She wondered dimly why she should feel so glad that he had found liberation, so certain that he was right, and yet refuse herself the same deliverance. Two sentences were beating in her mind. One was the triumphant sweep of, "He's free. He's out of their reach." The other was like a prayer of dedication. "There's still a chance to win. But let me be the only victim." It was strange, she thought in the days that followed, looking at the men around her, that catastrophe had made them aware of Hank Reardon with an intensity that his achievements had not aroused, as if the paths of their consciousness were open to disaster, but not to value. Some spoke of him in shrill curses, others whispered with a look of guilt and terror, as if a nameless retribution were now to descend upon them. Some tried, with hysterical evasiveness, to act as if nothing had happened. The newspapers, like puppets on tangled strings, were shouting with the same belligerence and on the same dates, "It is social treason to ascribe too much importance to Hank Reardon's desertion, and to undermine public morale by the old-fashioned belief that an individual can be of any significance to society. It is social treason to spread rumors about the disappearance of Hank Reardon. Mr. Reardon has not disappeared. He is in his office, running his mills as usual. And there has been no trouble at Reardon's Steel except a minor disturbance, a private scuffle among some workers. It is social treason to cast an unpatriotic light upon the tragic loss of Hank Reardon. Mr. Reardon is not deserted. He was killed in an automobile accident on his way to work, and his grief-stricken family has insisted on a private funeral. It was strange, she thought, to obtain news by means of nothing but denials, as if existence had ceased, facts had vanished, and only the frantic negatives uttered by officials and columnists gave any clue to the reality they were denying. It is not true that the Miller Steel Foundry of New Jersey has gone out of business. It is not true that the Janssen Motor Company of Michigan has closed its doors. It is a vicious antisocial lie that manufacturers of steel products are collapsing under the threat of a steel shortage. There is no reason to expect a steel shortage. It is a slanderous, unfounded rumor that a steel unification plan had been in the making and that it had been favored by Mr. Orrin Boyle. Mr. Boyle's attorney has issued an emphatic denial and has assured the press that Mr. Boyle is now vehemently opposed to any such plan. Mr. Boyle at the moment is suffering from a nervous breakdown. But some news could be witnessed in the streets of New York, in the cold, dank twilight of autumn evenings. A crowd gathered in front of a hardware store where the owner had thrown the doors open, inviting people to help themselves to the last of his meager stock, while he laughed in shrieking sobs and went smashing his plate glass windows. A crowd gathered at the door of a rundown apartment house, where a police ambulance stood waiting while the bodies of a man, his wife, and their three children were being removed from a gas-filled room. The man had been a small manufacturer of steel castings. If they see Hank Reardon's value now, she thought, why didn't they see it sooner? Why hadn't they averted their own doom and spared him his years of thankless torture? She found no answer. In the silence of sleepless nights, she thought that Hank Reardon and she had now changed places. He was in Atlantis, and she was locked out by a screen of light. He was, perhaps, calling to her as she had called to his struggling airplane, but no signal could reach her through that screen. Yet the screen split open for one brief break, for the length of a letter she received a week after he vanished. The envelope bore no return address, only the postmark of some hamlet in Colorado. The letter contained two sentences. I have met him. I don't blame you. H.R. She sat still for a long time, looking at the letter, as if unable to move or to feel. She felt nothing, she thought. Then noticed that her shoulders were trembling in a faint, continuous shudder. Then grasped that the tearing violence within her was made of an exultant tribute of gratitude and of despair. Her tribute to the victory that the meeting of those two men implied, the final victory of both. Her gratitude that those in Atlantis still regarded her as one of them, and had granted her the exception of receiving a message. The despair of the knowledge that her blankness was a struggle not to hear the questions she was now hearing. Had Galt abandoned her? Had he gone to the valley to meet his greatest conquest? Would he come back? Had he given her up? The unendurable was not that these questions had no answer, but that the answer was so simply, so easily within her reach, and that she had no right to take a step to reach it. She had made no attempt to see him. Every morning for a month on entering her office, she had been conscious, not of the room around her, but of the tunnels below, under the floors of the building. And she had worked, feeling as if some marginal part of her brain was computing figures, reading reports, making decisions in a rush of lifeless activity, while her living mind was inactive and still, frozen in contemplation, forbidden to move beyond the sentence, "He's down there." The only inquiry she had permitted herself had been a glance at the payroll list of the terminal workers. She had seen the name, Galt John. The list had carried it openly for over 12 years. She had seen an address next to the name, and for a month had struggled to forget it. It had seemed hard to live through that month. Yet now as she looked at the letter, the thought that Galt had gone was still harder to bear. Even the struggle of resisting his proximity had been a link to him, a price to pay, a victory achieved in his name. Now there was nothing except a question that was not to be asked. His presence in the tunnels had been her motor through those days, just as his presence in the city had been her motor through the months of that summer, just as his presence somewhere in the world had been her motor through the years before she ever heard his name. Now she felt as if her motor, too, had stopped. She went on, with the bright, pure glitter of a $5 gold piece, which she kept in her pocket, as her last drop of fuel. She went on, protected from the world around her by a last armor. Indifference. The newspapers did not mention the outbreaks of violence that had begun to burst across the country, but she watched them through the reports of train conductors about bullet-riddled cars, dismantled tracks, attacked trains, besieged stations. In Nebraska, in Oregon, in Texas, in Montana, the futile, doomed outbreaks prompted by nothing but despair, ending in nothing but destruction. Some were the explosions of local gangs, some spread wider. There were districts that rose in blind rebellion, arrested the local officials, expelled the agents of Washington, killed the tax collectors, then announcing their secession from the country, went on to the final extreme of the very evil that had destroyed them, as if fighting murder with suicide. Went on to seize all property within their reach, to declare community bondage of all to all, and to perish within a week, their meager loot consumed in the bloody hatred of all for all, in the chaos of no rule save that of the gun, to perish under the lethargic thrust of a few worn soldiers sent out from Washington to bring order to the ruins. The newspapers did not mention it. The editorials went on speaking of self-denial as the road to future progress, of self-sacrifice as the moral imperative, of greed as the enemy, of love as the solution. Their threadbare phrases as sickeningly sweet as the odor of ether in a hospital. Rumors went spreading through the country in whispers of cynical terror, yet people read the newspapers and acted as if they believed what they read, each competing with the others on who would keep most blindly silent, each pretending that he did not know what he knew, each striving to believe that the unnamed was the unreal. It was as if a volcano were cracking open, yet the people at the foot of the mountain ignored the sudden fissures, the black fumes, the boiling trickles, and went on believing that their only danger was to acknowledge the reality of these signs. Listen to Mr. Thompson's report on the world crisis, November 22nd. It was the first acknowledgment of the unacknowledged. The announcements began to appear a week in advance and went ringing across the country. Mr. Thompson will give the people a report on the world crisis. Listen to Mr. Thompson on every radio station and television channel at 8 p.m. on November 22nd. First, the front pages of the newspapers and the shouts of the radio voices had explained it. To counteract the fears and rumors spread by the enemies of the people, Mr. Thompson will address the country on November 22nd and will give us a full report on the state of the world in this solemn moment of global crisis. Mr. Thompson will put an end to those sinister forces whose purpose is to keep us in terror and despair. He will bring light into the darkness of the world and will show us the way out of our tragic problems. A stern way, as befits the gravity of this hour, but a way of glory as granted by the rebirth of light. Mr. Thompson's address will be carried by every radio station in this country and in all countries throughout the world, wherever radio waves may still be heard. Then the chorus broke loose and went growing day by day. Listen to Mr. Thompson on November 22nd, said daily headlines. Don't forget Mr. Thompson on November 22nd, cried radio stations at the end of every program. Mr. Thompson will tell you the truth, said placards in subways and buses. Then posters on the walls of buildings, then billboards on deserted highways. Don't despair, listen to Mr. Thompson, said pennants on government cars. Don't give up, listen to Mr. Thompson, said banners in offices and shops. Have faith, listen to Mr. Thompson, said voices in churches. Mr. Thompson will give you the answer, wrote army airplanes across the sky, the letters dissolving in space, and only the last two words remaining by the time the sentence was completed. Public loudspeakers were built in the squares of New York for the day of the speech and came to rasping life once an hour in time with the ringing of distant clocks to send over the worn rattle of the traffic, over the heads of the shabby crowds, the sonorous mechanical cry of an alarm-toned voice. Listen to Mr. Thompson's report on the world crisis, November 22nd. A cry rolling through the frosted air, and vanishing among the foggy rooftops, under the blank page of a calendar that bore no date. On the afternoon of November 22nd, James Taggart told Dagny that Mr. Thompson wished to meet her for a conference before the broadcast. In Washington? She asked incredulously, glancing at her watch.
Well, I must say that you haven't been reading the newspapers or keeping track of important events. Don't you know that Mr. Thompson is to broadcast from New York? He has come here to confer with the leaders of industry as well as of labor, science, the professions, and the best of the country's leadership in general. He has requested that I bring you to the conference.
Where is it to be held?
At the broadcasting studio.
They don't expect me to speak on the air in support of their policies, do they?
Don't worry. They wouldn't let you near a microphone. They just want to hear your opinion, and you can't refuse, not in a national emergency. Not when it's an invitation from Mr. Thompson in person.
He spoke impatiently, avoiding her eyes. When is that conference to be held?
At 7:30.
Not much time to give to a conference about a national emergency, is it?
Mr. Thompson is a very busy man. Now, please don't argue. Don't start being difficult. I don't see what you're...
All right, she said indifferently. I'll come. And added, prompted by the kind of feeling that would have made her reluctant to venture without a witness into a conference of gangsters, but I'll bring Eddie Willers along with me. He frowned, considering it for a moment, with a look of annoyance more than anxiety.
Oh, all right, if you wish, he snapped, shrugging.
She came to the broadcasting studio with James Taggart as a policeman at one side of her, and Eddie Willers as a bodyguard at the other. Taggart's face was resentful and tense. Eddie's resigned, yet wondering and curious. A stage set of pasteboard walls had been erected in a corner of the vast, dim space, representing a stiffly traditional suggestion of a cross between a stately drawing room and a modest study. A semicircle of empty armchairs filled the set, suggesting a grouping from a family album, with microphones dangling like bait at the end of long poles extended for fishing among the chairs. The best leadership of the country, that stood about in nervous clusters, had the look of a remnant sale in a bankrupt store. She saw Wesley Mooch, Eugene Lawson, Chick Morrison, Tinky Holloway, Dr. Floyd Ferris, Dr. Simon Pritchett, Ma Chalmers, Fred Kinnon, and a seedy handful of businessmen, among whom the half-scared, half-flattered figure of Mr. Moen of the Amalgamated Switch and Signal Company was, incredibly, intended to represent an industrial tycoon. But the figure that gave her an instant shock was Dr. Robert Statler. She had not known that a face could age so greatly within the brief space of 1 year. The look of timeless energy, of boyish eagerness, was gone, and nothing remained of the face except the lines of contemptuous bitterness. He stood alone, apart from the others, and she saw the moment when his eyes saw her enter. He looked like a man in a whorehouse who had accepted the nature of his surroundings until suddenly caught there by his wife. It was a look of guilt in the process of becoming hatred. Then she saw Robert Stadler, the scientist, turn away as if he had not seen her, as if his refusal to see could wipe a fact out of existence. Mr. Thompson was pacing among the groups, snapping at random bystanders in the restless manner of a man of action who feels contempt for the duty of making speeches. He was clutching a sheaf of typewritten pages, as if it were a bundle of old clothing about to be discarded. James Taggart caught him in mid-step to say uncertainly and loudly, "Mr. Thompson, may I present my sister, Miss Stagney Taggart?" "So nice of you to come, Miss Taggart," said Mr. Thompson, shaking her hand as if she were another voter from back home, whose name he had never heard before. Then he marched briskly off. "Where's the conference, Jim?" she asked, and glanced at the clock. It was a huge white dial with a black hand, slicing the minutes, like a knife moving toward the hour of 8.
"I can't help it. I don't run this show," he snapped.
Eddie Willers glanced at her with a look of bitterly patient astonishment and stepped closer to her side. A radio receiver was playing a program of military marches broadcast from another studio, half-drowning the fragments of nervous voices, of hastily aimless steps, of screeching machinery being pulled to focus upon the drawing-room set. "Stay tuned to hear Mr. Thompson report on the world crisis at 8 p.m., cried the martial voice of an announcer from the radio receiver when the hand on the dial reached the hour of 7:45. "Step on it, boys, step on it," snapped Mr. Thompson, while the radio burst into another march. It was 7:50 when Chick Morrison, the morale conditioner, who seemed to be in charge, cried, "All right, boys and girls, all right, let's take our places," waving a bunch of notepaper like a baton toward the light-flooded circle of armchairs. Mr. Thompson thudded down upon the central chair in the manner of grabbing a vacant seat in a subway. Chick Morrison's assistants were herding the crowd toward the circle of light. "A happy family," Chick Morrison explained. "The country must see us as a big, united, happy..." "What's the matter with that thing?" The radio music had gone off abruptly, choking on an odd little gasp of static, cut in the middle of a ringing phrase. It was 7:51. He shrugged and went on. "Happy family. Hurry up, boys. Take close-ups of Mr. Thompson first." The hand of the clock went slicing off the minutes, while press photographers clicked their cameras at Mr. Thompson's sourly impatient face. "Mr. Thompson will sit between science and industry," Chick Morrison announced. "Dr. Stadler, please, the chair on Mr. Thompson's left. Miss Taggart, this way, please, on Mr. Thompson's right." Dr. Stadler obeyed. She did not move. "It's not just for the press, it's for the television audiences," Chick Morrison explained to her in the tone of an inducement. She made a step forward. "I will not take part in this program," she said evenly, addressing Mr. Thompson. "You won't?" he asked blankly, with the kind of look he would have worn if one of the flower vases had suddenly refused to perform its part.
"Dagny, for Christ's sake!" cried James Taggart in panic.
"What's the matter with her?" asked Mr. Thompson.
"But Miss Taggart, why?"
cried Chick Morrison. "You all know why," she said to the faces around her. "You should have known better than to try that again."
"Miss Taggart!"
yelled Chick Morrison as she turned to go.
"It's a national emergency."
Then a man came rushing toward Mr. Thompson, and she stopped, as did everyone else, and the look on the man's face swept the crowd into an abruptly total silence. He was the station's chief engineer, and it was odd to see a look of primitive terror struggling against his remnant of civilized control. "Mr. Thompson," he said, we might have to delay the broadcast."
"What?"
cried Mr. Thompson. The hand of the dial stood at 7:58. "We're trying to fix it, Mr. Thompson. We're trying to find out what it is. But we might not be on time, and..."
"What are you talking about? What happened?"
"We're trying to locate the..."
"What happened? I don't know, but..."
We can't get on the air, Mr. Thompson." There was a moment of silence. Then Mr. Thompson asked, his voice unnaturally low, "Are you crazy?"
"I must be. I wish I were. I can't make it out. The station is dead."
"Mechanical trouble?"
yelled Mr. Thompson, leaping to his feet.
"Mechanical trouble? God damn you, at a time like this? If that's how you run this station..."
The chief engineer shook his head slowly in the manner of an adult who is reluctant to frighten a child.
"It's not this station, Mr. Thompson," he said softly. "It's every station in the country, as far as we've been able to check. And there is no mechanical trouble, neither here nor elsewhere. The equipment is in order, in perfect order, and they all report the same, but all radio stations went off the air at 7:51, and nobody can discover why."
"But,"
cried Mr. Thompson, stopped, glanced about him, and screamed,
"Not tonight! You can't let it happen tonight! You've got to get me on the air!"
"Mr. Thompson," the man said slowly, "we've called the electronic laboratory of the State Science Institute. They've never seen anything like it. They said it might be a natural phenomenon, some sort of cosmic disturbance of an unprecedented kind. Only..."
"Well?"
"Only they don't think it is. We don't either. They said it looks like radio waves, but of a frequency never produced before, never observed anywhere, never discovered by anybody." No one answered him. In a moment, he went on, his voice oddly solemn, "It looks like a wall of radio waves jamming the air. And we can't get through it. We can't touch it. We can't break it. What's more, we can't locate its source, not by any of our usual methods. Those waves seem to come from a transmitter that makes any known to us look like a child's toy."
"But that's not possible!"
The cry came from behind Mr. Thompson, and they all whirled in its direction, startled by its note of peculiar terror. It came from Dr. Stadler.
"There's no such thing. There's nobody on earth to make it."
The chief engineer spread his hands out.
"That's it, Dr. Stadler," he said wearily. "It can't be possible. It shouldn't be possible. But there it is."
"Well, do something about it,"
cried Mr. Thompson to the crowd at large. No one answered or moved.
"I won't permit this," cried Mr. Thompson. "I won't permit it tonight of all nights. I've got to make that speech. Do something. Solve it, whatever it is. I order you to solve it."
The chief engineer was looking at him blankly. I'll fire the lot of you for this. I'll fire every electronic engineer in the country. I'll put the whole profession on trial for sabotage, desertion, and treason. Do you hear me? Now do something. God damn you, do something.
The chief engineer was looking at him impassively, as if words were not conveying anything any longer.
Isn't there anybody around to obey an order? Cried Mr. Thompson. Isn't there a brain left in this country?
The hand of the clock reached the dot of 8 o'clock. Ladies and gentlemen, said a voice that came from the radio receiver, a man's clear, calm, implacable voice, the kind of voice that had not been heard on the airwaves for years. Mr. Thompson will not speak to you tonight. His time is up. I have taken it over. You were to hear a report on the world crisis. That is what you are going to hear. 3 gasps of recognition greeted the voice, but nobody had the power to notice them among the sounds of the crowd, which were beyond the stage of cries. One was a gasp of triumph, another of terror, the third of bewilderment. 3 persons had recognized the speaker: Dagny, Dr. Stadler, Eddie Willers. Nobody glanced at Eddie Willers, but Dagny and Dr. Stadler glanced at each other. She saw that his face was distorted by as evil a terror as one could ever bear to see. He saw that she knew, and that the way she looked at him was as if the speaker had slapped his face. For 12 years you have been asking, who is John Galt? This is John Galt speaking. I am the man who loves his life. I am the man who does not sacrifice his love or his values. I am the man who has deprived you of victims, and thus has destroyed your world. And if you wish to know why you are perishing, you who dread knowledge, I am the man who will now tell you. The chief engineer was the only one able to move. He ran to a television set and struggled frantically with its dials. But the screen remained empty. The speaker had not chosen to be seen. Only his voice filled the airways of the country. Of the world, thought the chief engineer, sounding as if he were speaking here in this room, not to a group, but to one man. It was not the tone of addressing a meeting, but the tone of addressing a mind. You have heard it said that this is an age of moral crisis. You have said it yourself, half in fear, half in hope that the words had no meaning. You have cried that man's sins are destroying the world, and you have cursed human nature for its unwillingness to practice the virtues you demanded. Since virtue to you consists of sacrifice, you have demanded more sacrifices at every successive disaster. In the name of a return to morality, you have sacrificed all those evils which you held as the cause of your plight. You have sacrificed justice to mercy. You have sacrificed independence to unity. You have sacrificed reason to faith. You have sacrificed wealth to need. You have sacrificed self-esteem to self-denial. You have sacrificed happiness to duty. You have destroyed all that which you held to be evil, and achieved all that which you held to be good. Why then do you shrink in horror from the sight of the world around you? That world is not the product of your sins. It is the product and the image of your virtues. It is your moral ideal brought into reality in its full and final perfection. You have fought for it. You have dreamed of it. You have wished it. And I am the man who has granted you your wish. Your ideal had an implacable enemy, which your code of morality was designed to destroy. I have withdrawn that enemy. I have taken it out of your way and out of your reach. I have removed the source of all those evils you were sacrificing one by one. I have ended your battle. I have stopped your motor. I have deprived your world of man's mind. Men do not live by the mind, you say. I have withdrawn those who do. The mind is impotent, you say. I have withdrawn those whose mind isn't. There are values higher than the mind, you say. I have withdrawn those for whom there aren't. While you were dragging to your sacrificial altars the men of justice, of independence, of reason, of wealth, of self-esteem, I beat you to it. I reached them first. I told them the nature of the game you were playing and the nature of that moral code of yours, which they had been too innocently generous to grasp. I showed them the way to live by another morality, mine.